Maboff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au or find me on social media as Honest Conman. On August the 25th, 1835, an article appeared in the Sun newspaper in New York making an extraordinary claim. Famed astronomer Sir John Herschel had created a revolutionary new telescope so powerful it could see the surface of the moon. There, the Sun claimed alien life had been discovered. Libaceous winged man-bats mated in the rolling fields while two-legged beavers grazed behind them. Abandoned temples of polished sapphire gleamed in the sun, and strange spherical creatures rolled across pebbly beaches. The hoax was the creation of journalist Richard Adam Locke, but the story behind this grand journalistic fraud is more fascinating than 100 fornicating batmen. On today's episode, Matthew Goodman, author of The Sun and the Moon, explains what led Locke to write these extraordinary articles and why what became known as the Great Moon Hoax wasn't really a hoax at all. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. This hoax, this grand elaborate hoax, it goes back to the early 19th century, and that's a time that there's many, many great hoaxes. There's P.T. Barnum is at the height of his powers, and you've got men like Edgar Allan Poe who are out constantly trying to pull the wool over the public's eyes. What was it about that time, particularly in American history, that made it so ripe for people to hoax and to be hoaxed?
And that's really an interesting question, and one that I certainly thought about a lot in writing this book. I mean, it's really remarkable that in the span of a single month, you know, we're talking about the summer of 1835, that in the span of that summer, Edgar Allan Poe, who you mentioned, wrote a story called Hans Fall, or The Unparalleled Adventure of Hans Fall, about a balloon journey to the moon, which he had hoped would fool some people. And then subsequently, a very young promoter, would-be showman from Connecticut by the name of Phineas Taylor Barnum, arrives in New York City with his first hoax, who was a woman named Joyce Heth, who was an old black woman who Barnum claimed was 161 years old and had been the nursemaid of George Washington as a baby. And that caused a great sensation in New York. Everyone wanted to see this 161-year-old woman. And a month after that, the moon hoax begins. So it all, you know, all of this is happening. There's a kind of hoax ferment that's going on in New York at that time. Well, why is that? And I think a lot of it has to do with the sort of emerging culture of the United States of that time, particularly in New York City. You know, the 1830s was a very important time, certainly in the history of New York City, but really in the history of the United States. It was really a democratizing moment in the history of the United States, a moment when the kind of old certitudes of the past were beginning to fade away and be replaced by new, more democratic ones. You know, in New York City, this was the moment when the mayor was first elected by the people. Up to that point, he had been appointed by the governor. In a social level, this was the moment when people started, they stopped tipping their hats and instead began shaking hands, which was a more democratic gesture. You know, when they stopped, when cartmen, you know, the cabmen stopped referring to their passengers as sir or lord or, you know, whatever it might be. So there was a great kind of democratic impulse that was going on in New York at that time. And oddly enough, and the other thing, of course, which we can talk more about, was that for the first time you have newspapers that are being directed at, for general readers, you know, not just for the elites of the society, but for the average people. You know, they only cost a penny instead of 6 cents, which they had cost before. That was a big part of the democratizing moment. And part of what it meant to be a citizen of a democracy was that you got to make up your mind about things, that you didn't have to just listen to what people told you was true, that part of your birthright, in a sense, as a citizen, was that you could make up your own mind. And that meant that you could go to Barnum's American Museum, and you can take a look at the various exhibitions that he had there, and you could decide for yourself whether or not what was claimed for that was true or not. And when people were deceived, they didn't feel that they had been in some way corrupted. They felt that, you know, good for you.
So it sounds like it was almost like a game, like a national sport of let's put out these ideas
exactly.
and see. And it doesn't matter if they're true or not. It really matters about whether you can figure out whether something is true
or not.
Well,
Barnum built his career on this. You know, Barnum became, an incredibly wealthy man on the basis of this. And he always said, you know, with my exhibitions, people are going to come three times, to see my humbugs. The first time because they believe it, the second time because they're not sure, and the third time because they wanted to see how I pulled it off. And it was a kind of a game between the promoter and the customer about are you going to fool me or not? And if not, how am I going to be able to figure out what you did? And you know, this is sort of skipping ahead, but after the Sun newspaper's hoax was revealed, people didn't turn away from the New York Sun newspaper. They didn't stop reading the Sun. They were very pleased and admiring of the great job that the Sun had done, and that was that.
It reminds me of the phrase, the unwary stranger, that was popular around that time and was often used as a defense or as a reason to prosecute a con artist. And that was that if you scam or swindle someone, that's fine, so long as they have a fighting chance of figuring out that they're being scammed or swindled. So if you...
Right.
If you defraud a wealthy, educated businessman, that's acceptable because he should know better than to be taken for a ride. Whereas if you were to scam an unwary stranger, someone who's come in from the country and has no real chance of figuring this out, then that's when you're a con artist and a swindler. And it sounds like that was a sort of prevailing attitude of the society, was that you can lie and cheat and swindle, you just need to give the person a fighting chance of figuring it out.
And these people didn't really think of themselves as being swindled. I mean, you know, if you were going to pay your 5 cents to go see Barnum's American Museum, you weren't being swindled. You were being entertained. You know, it's a little different than someone pulling one over you on you on the street or something like that. And Richard Adams Locke, who was the author of the Moon Hoax, put all kinds of clues in there that he really expected people were going to get, and then people didn't get. But then in retrospect, people said, "Oh, how could we possibly have believed that?" But of course, they did.
And that, I guess, is one of the keys to a good hoax, is that it needs to stretch credulity far enough that in hindsight you maybe should have figured it out. A bit like a murder mystery, if you get to the end and you can predict, you can go, of course that's who the murderer is, it's so obvious now.
Richard Adams Locke really believed that it was going to be figured out. I mean, it went on for a while. It was 6 articles, and he was sure that by the time you got to the end, people would have figured it out by then, but people didn't. And, you know, he refers to himself, when it was all said and done, as the best self-hoaxed man in New York, because he really hadn't intended for it to go as far as it did. But that's a whole other story.
So if we go back then to the Sun newspaper itself, it was one of the first of the penny presses, is that right? One of
the first one.
So it really was a revolutionary publication in that was that the first paper to kind of use newsboys?
It was the very first paper to use newsboys, which revolutionized news delivery in the United States. You know, up to that point, in 1833, when the Sun started publication, there were 11 daily newspapers in New York City, 7 morning papers and 4 afternoon papers, evening papers. So that seems like a lot, but they had a combined circulation, these 11 papers, a combined circulation of only 26,000 in a city of over 250,000 people. They were not intended for the average person. You know, they cost a lot of money. They were very large, so large that you had to spread it out on a desk. You couldn't, you know, carry it around with you in your pocket and so forth. And they had the sort of articles that would really only appeal to the upper class. You know, they were about ships launchings and commodity prices and news from abroad and so forth, they really didn't speak to the concerns of the average person. And then along comes this young radical printer by the name of Benjamin Day, who says, I'm going to create a newspaper for the average person, and it's only going to cost a penny. And I'm going to put in it the kinds of news that people really want to read, you know, which includes, of course, crime. You know, there was a tremendous emphasis on crime news, on entertainment, on gossip, on stories, on jokes, on theater reviews and so forth. And it really created the kind of template for the tabloid papers of today. And the paper proved incredibly popular and had soon overtaken what were known as the mercantile papers in its circulation very quickly.
It was a part of the business plan to, because as I understand it, he avoided things like subscriptions and political donations and having the content
right.
decided that way, that he was selling the paper every single day to people who would just choose to whether they wanted to buy that paper or not. And so that meant
right.
that every paper needed to have a hook, needed to have a reason to buy it and the reason to keep buying it, whereas the subscription, you could sort of decide at the end of the year whether you were going to
that's right, and
subscription
you needed to have... Yeah, and you needed to have a certain amount of loose capital that you could invest in a year subscription to a paper. You know, the editors of that time considered themselves aristocrats, you know, and it was sort of beneath them to be going out and selling your paper on the street like it was an apple or a pencil or something. You know, that was kind of beneath them, you know. So, but Benjamin Day had a new kind of selling plan, and he put an advertisement in one of the first issues of the paper advertising for unemployed men to, you know, have an opportunity to make some extra money by selling their paper on street corners, you know, down at ships' landings and wherever the places where the poor people of the city congregated. And as it happened, the very first person who showed up was this young boy, an Irish immigrant. You know, this was the moment when Irish immigrants were first arriving in great numbers in New York City. There's a guy called Bernard Flaherty who said, I want the job. And he, you know, Benjamin Day gave him a bunch of papers and sent them off. And Flaherty turned out to be this sort of amazing seller. And he grew up to be a great actor on the stage in New York. And he was the first newsboy. And that really kind of set the standard for the way that news got sold, or newspapers got sold in New York for another century, more than a century, century and a half.
So really you have the sort of perfect storm then for this hoax to come out. You've got this brand new paper that's just starting to get attention. You've got a way of getting it out to the people. And you've got this, I guess, social tension between the rich and the poor that... really makes people sort of, I guess, as we said, you know, keen to kind of be able to pull the wool over each other's eyes and to play these games. This is when, obviously, Richard Adams Locke sort of comes onto the scene. He was British, is that right?
Yes, he was British, although he claimed later in life to be an American. He was actually British. He was from Somerset in the southwest of England. You know, a lot of what I discovered was told about the life of Richard Adams Locke turned out to be mythical. I mean, he was a great myth maker. And there really wasn't all that much known about Richard Adams Locke. You know, as a writer, you know, you'll appreciate this, that I was starting out to research this book, and I knew that Richard Adams Locke was going to be inevitably the main character, but he was always described as the enigmatic Richard Adams Locke. You know, people didn't really know very much about him, and a lot of what people thought they knew about him turned out, I discovered, to be not true. But he was, in fact, English. He was born in the southwest of England. He came from a somewhat well-to-do family, but he had differences with his father and his grandfather. And he was a political radical and wanted to be a journalist and not be a, you know, one of the landed gentry that his father wanted him to be. And he tried to make his way as a radical journalist in London and then returned to the southwest of England and eventually got essentially exiled from England for his radical political views and came to New York to try to make his way in this new kind of Wild West world of newspapering in New York. And he met Benjamin Day because he was covering the sensational trial that was going on in New York at the time of a guy called Matthias the Prophet, who was a carpenter whose real name I think was Robert Matthews, but he was a self-styled prophet, called himself Matthias, and he would walk around lower Manhattan in these great robes with a cane and an orb and so forth, and he would proclaim this kind of odd theology against ministers and loose women, and oddly, men with spectacles were a target of his. And like many cult leaders, he tried to get upper class people to join his cult because they had a lot of money, and he was fairly successful about that. And they ended up buying property in upstate New York and having a kind of commune up there, and Matthias the Prophet developed a kind of harem for himself. He had seven women in this harem, six white, one for each day of the week, six white women and one black woman. The black woman was a former slave who called herself Isabella Van Wagenen, who, after the cult was dissolved, changed her name to Sojourner Truth and became one of the leading abolitionists in the United States. And she's very, very well known today as Sojourner Truth, but she had started as a member of this cult. And Matthias the Prophet was accused of poisoning one of his disciples, and there was this great scandalous trial that was being held in New York City, and Richard Adams Locke was covering it as a freelance reporter for one of the other papers, and Benjamin Day liked him very much, he liked his writing very much, and he got Richard Adams Locke to write a pamphlet for The Sun, an anonymous pamphlet for The Sun, about the case, which sold a lot of copies, and Day said to Locke, if you ever come up with anything else that's going to sell a lot of copies, let me know. And Locke said he would think about it, and eventually he became editor of The Sun. They hired him to become editor of The Sun, and he came up with this series that turned out to be a phenomenal seller. And by the time it was over, The Sun had become the most widely read newspaper in the entire world.
It seemed like a lot of Locke's work was basically to be skeptical of religion and of extraordinary scientific claims and people who made these claims without any real evidence to back it up. And that was really one of his motivations for the hoax.
That's what I discovered. That's what I discovered over the course of my research. I mean, I think we should probably mention what these articles even were. You know, the Sun in the summer of 1835 announced out of the blue that they had received a copy of a Scottish scientific journal, the Edinburgh Journal of Science, that reported the most unbelievable lunar or celestial discoveries made by the great astronomer John Herschel. John Herschel was a real astronomer. He was probably the most famous astronomer in the world at that time, the son of William Herschel, who was in his own right a great astronomer. And he conveniently was in South Africa at that time, many, many weeks away, by mail. So he couldn't say, no, this isn't true, because news didn't get to him for a long time. And supposedly, according to this Scottish journal, he had with him in South Africa this remarkable new telescope called the Hydro-Oxygen Telescope, which was by far the most powerful telescope that had ever been conceived. And with it, he had discovered the most amazing things, including life on the moon. And in a series of six articles that, you know, spooled themselves out over the course of 10 days, the Sun revealed, or supposedly was reprinting this, you know, this article from the Scottish Journal about what they were finding on the moon. And with each day's episode, the discoveries became ever more fantastic. You know, so in the beginning, they just discovered a field of poppies, which was like Richard Adams Locke's little inside joke, you know, because it was like an opium dream, really. And then they discover sheep, and then they discover unicorns, and then they discover a hairy bison, and then they discover biped beavers, beavers that walk on their hind legs and had apparently discovered the secret of fire. And then in the final episode, the most remarkable discovery of all, they find lunar man bats, which supposedly John Herschel had dubbed Vespertilio Homo, you know, these man bats. And these man bats were remarkable creatures. They talked and they flew and they apparently had constructed lunar temples. And they, you know, did art, and they fornicated in public, by the way, which caused a big sensation. But, you know, the Sun, hewing to the Times, didn't really go into detail about that, but that caused quite a sensation as well. And that just, you know, caused a tremendous sensation. And all of New York was abuzz with the news of the great discoveries on the moon. And though we might find it preposterous today, every account of New York at that time says that the vast majority of people believed it. By some accounts, you know, 9 out of 10 people believed these stories. And everybody, whether you were rich or poor, were buying copies of the Sun to find out what was going to be discovered next. And people were talking about it on the street and in the restaurants and on the docks and wherever people were congregating. And little by little, you know, the Sun's rivals, they didn't know what to do about it. And eventually they began reprinting the story in their own papers. Some of them even went so far as to claim that they had gotten a copy of this very same Scottish Journal, this imaginary journal, and were reprinting it as well. And then the news began to spread around the country, and it was being picked up by newspapers everywhere, and eventually it spread to Europe and was printed in Germany and Italy and England and all across Europe. It was the most reported, quote-unquote, news story of the time.
But that's not to say that there weren't some skeptics. There was surely some newspapers or journals who came out and said, hang on, this can't be true. There must be problems.
There was one. By this point, there was another penny paper who was run by a guy called James Gordon Bennett. And he railed against the Sun and proclaimed about what a hoax it was and how it wasn't true and it couldn't be true and, you know, vowed to prove that all of this wasn't true. But he was a bit of a voice in the wilderness. People, you know, the vast majority of people did believe this. And it's sort of a fascinating question about why is it that so many people did believe it? And there are reasons why so many people did believe it. Some of it is just that Richard Adams Locke was this incredibly erudite guy who knew a lot, who was a great student of astronomy and kept up with all of the latest astronomical news and was able to write in a really reputable seeming way. So that was part of it. But the other thing that was really going on, which was so fascinating, had to do, and you were talking about this earlier, it had to do with the common belief at that time among a group of astronomers known as the religious astronomers that there was life on other planets and on the moon. And that was kind of the going wisdom of the time. And so this series seemed to only confirm what people already wanted to believe anyway. And this, I think, is true about so many successful hoaxes, which is that they tend to confirm what people already want to believe.
And not only that, they take what people already believe, they present it to them, and then exaggerate it and make it bigger and start with this little kernel of fact or common sense or believability and then just get bigger and bigger. It reminds me a lot of the sort of self-help books, like, I don't know, maybe The Secret is the one that always springs to mind. The book's premise is that based on the law of attractions, and so and if you have a positive attitude in life, good things will happen to you. The law of attraction is a real thing, and having a positive attitude is common sense. And then it exaggerates it to the point of, like, you just close your eyes and imagine, you know, that you want a Porsche. You'll get a Porsche eventually if you wish for it hard enough, and the universe will grant it to you. And so it takes what, you know, it takes wishful thinking and common sense, and then it blows them up out of all proportion.
Well, people at that time, they wanted to believe that we were not alone in the universe, you know. And astronomy at that time was a kind of subset of theology. You know, the great American universities had all been founded by religions. And even John Herschel believed in life on other planets. You know, he had himself speculated that there was a race of creatures that lived on comets who were giant. That was an idea that he had. And it was a fairly common thing for astronomers at that time to speculate on what the creatures who lived on celestial bodies looked like. You know, that the creatures who lived on Saturn had great eyes to compensate for the dim light, you know, from the sun, which is so far away. And there was a guy named Thomas Dick, who was a Scottish astronomer, who was kind of the Carl Sagan of his time. He was extremely popular.
Hang on, is this the Christian philosopher?
Yeah. Yeah,
but, I mean, he was the Carl Sagan of his time in that he was charismatic and known for his thoughts on science. But he was a crazy man, wasn't he? Sorry, I thought my understanding of him was that he was a nut job.
Well, I don't know if he was a nut. He wrote many, many books, and they were very, very widely read about astronomy, and pretty well respected. He speculated that the moon was inhabited by 4 billion creatures, because he had this idea that the moon was as densely populated as England. I don't know why he would think that, and therefore it would have 4.2 billion creatures on it. And I love this idea that comet were inhabited by a race of navigators, because they had such a good view of the solar system as they made their way around, you know, on these comets. But, you know, his idea, and this is a theological idea, was that there had to be life elsewhere in the universe, because God, in his infinite wisdom, would not create worlds without creating at the same time intelligent beings there to appreciate them. And so, therefore, the universe must be populated. And that was a very widely believed idea at that time. And, you know, astronomers spent a lot of time thinking, how are we going to communicate, you know, with these creatures on the moon? Are we, you know, should we build vast geometric shapes on the plains of Siberia as a way to communicate with them? Should we create huge fires as a kind of flare to attract their attention and so forth? And Richard Adams Locke, who was a great believer in science, understood that these were profoundly misguided ideas, that this was theology masquerading as science. And, you know, he had friends who were geologists who had given up their profession, because their research was leading them inescapably to the understanding that the universe was, in fact, billions of years old and had not been created in the year 4004 BC, as Bishop Usher of Ireland, you know, had supposedly figured out. And Locke tried to dissuade them from that, but was unable to do so. So he was very upset at what he saw as religion's successful effort to halt the free inquiry of science. And so he decided, I'm going to write a series that is going to satirize the ideas of these religious astronomers. You know, if they believe that there's life on the moon, I will give them life on the moon. And if they believe that these creatures have to be religious, I am or even Christian, I will give them lunarian temples on the moon. And I will dress it up with all of this kind of absurd science in the way that they do as a way of poking fun at it. But what happened, and this is why he was the, as he called himself, the best self-hoaxed man in New York, was that people had been so predisposed to believe this that when they read it, they believed it. And then when it was finally revealed that he had been the author, they accused him of being a hoaxer. He hadn't been a hoaxer. He hadn't meant for it to be believed, and he hadn't intended it as a hoax. He had intended it as a satire.
Even if you leave motivations aside of why he did it and just look at the work, it feels like the only reason it is a hoax, as opposed to what Thomas Stick was writing at the same time, was that Locke said that he had proof. You know, he said that he had this access to this report, Herschel's telescope.
Right.
And if you remove the telescope, if it was just him saying, rather than him saying, there is a telescope that has seen these things, he just said, there are man-bats on the moon and abandoned temples to long-forgotten gods on the moon, he would have been no different. His work would have been no different from Thomas Dick.
You know, that's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. You're exactly right. I mean, really what he was claiming was not any more eccentric or extreme than the sort of suppositions that were being made regularly in the scientific press. You know, these weren't on, you know, these weren't being distributed on, you know, in self-produced pamphlets on street corners. These were being produced in the leading scientific journals of the time, articles with titles like "The Moon and Its Inhabitants." You know, those, you know, that was the title of an article that Locke read. So you're right. You know, his claims were not really so extreme. It was the fact that he claimed that it had all been achieved by means of this imaginary telescope by John Herschel.
It does all remind me of some of the more recent religious links to outer space. I don't know, Heaven's Gate cult, or even Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
That idea of the universe, that the other planets and the stars and the moon are so, they're above us all, and yet at the same time they're so far away and so impossible for us to grasp, that we have to make up these extraordinary stories in order to understand them.
It's really a contemporary story in a certain way. You know, I mean, even to this day, you have religion attempting to assert its dominion over science, you know, where you have people who still claim that evolution is not true because it doesn't conform with the strictly literal interpretation of the Bible, where you have people saying that we shouldn't be using stem cells in research because it goes against our religion and this and that. You know, I would go around and I would give talks about this book when it first came out, and people would say, oh, you know, people were so unsophisticated then. How could they possibly have believed this kind of thing? And, you know, I remember when the book first came out, it was shortly after Barack Obama had been elected president of the United States. And at that time, a survey had been taken of voters in Texas, and half of them believed that he was a Muslim. That's a hoax. You know, that's a hoax that was perpetrated on the American public and continues to be perpetrated on the American public. And again, believed by wide sections of the public because it tends to confirm what they would like to believe anyway.
I guess, though, the big difference is we have access to information that clearly proves that wrong, whereas, you know, we can just go to Snopes.com on our phone and find out whether it's true in 5 minutes.
They didn't have Snopes.
Yeah.
Right. And, of course, back then, you know, I mean, if it had happened today, John Herschel would have just texted
tweeted
us
about it.
South Africa or tweeted, this is not true. This is not true. And, yeah, the Internet is a perfectly good purveyor of hoaxes, as well, as we all know. So, you know, I don't think that the mass of the public is any more or less gullible than they were 180 years ago.
What was Herschel's reaction when he found out that this was going on?
Well, it's great. You know, he didn't find out for a long time. I mean, he was in South Africa doing a sweep of the southern skies. And what happened was that there was a guy called Caleb Weeks, who was actually an owner of kind of a forerunner of a zoo, which was called a menagerie, which was something like a circus, where, you know, they had a collection of animals and they would bring it into town and people would come to, you know, look at a giraffe or a rhinoceros or whatever kind of animal that they had never seen before. So he had gone to South Africa in search of new, never-before-seen creatures, and he was staying at this hotel where John Herschel was staying, and he asked to meet Herschel, and he did, and he congratulated him on his great discoveries, and Herschel said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "The discoveries on the moon." And the moon was about the only place that Herschel was not looking at that time. And Herschel said, "What are you talking about?" And he gave him a copy of the Sun series, which he had brought with him. And Herschel's eyes popped out of his head, and he said, "Excuse me." And he went off and he read it, and he came back and he said, Is anybody believing this nonsense?" And Caleb Weeks said, "Oh, yes, it's all over New York." And Herschel took it in good humor at first. You know, he thought it was kind of preposterous. But as time went on, he began to receive letters from all over the world, you know, in German and in Italian and French, asking him about his great lunar discoveries. And at that point, I think he began to get perturbed and increasingly frustrated. And at one point, you know, he writes a letter to his sister about these damnable discoveries made in my name.
He was really the perfect person to choose because he was far away. You know, he's in South Africa and difficult to get.
Yeah.
He was a bit of a polymath and known for examining multiple different scientific disciplines.
Right.
But also had a history with photography as well. And so the idea of this guy being responsible for this new lens that was able to somehow see the moon, it made sense because he was, you know, an early proponent of photography.
And he was extremely well known. I mean, he was probably the most famous astronomer in the world at that time, and had also speculated on the possibility of life on other planets. So you're right. He was really the ideal person for Locke to have hit on.
What was the outcome? Once he had publicly dismissed the hoax, and once it was revealed that it was definitely made up and Locke had admitted it, insofar as it said he had written a fiction. You said that the Sun newspaper didn't affect their circulation at all, and did the Sun just continue to go from strength to strength after this all blew over?
They did. You know, for a long time, Locke did not admit that he had done this. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, but what I think was going on was that Locke felt that the secret wasn't his to tell, that he was an employee of the paper, that Benjamin Day had paid him for his services, and it was really up to Benjamin Day, the publisher, to reveal the secret. But Locke was also something of a drinker. He ended up becoming an alcoholic, and one night he was out drinking with a friend of his who worked for a rival paper, and his friend said, "You know, we're about to start reprinting your series." And Locke said to him something as a kind of a word to the wise, "Don't do it. I wrote it." And his friend, rather than taking it as a word to the wise, took it as a scoop and published, you know, the story that said Locke admitted that he had written this. And that further confirmed the speculation that had been fostered by the rival James Gordon Bennett and so forth. And eventually it became sort of acknowledged implicitly that Locke had done it. But as we were talking about earlier, the Sun never decreased in popularity as a result of this. You know, the Sun's rivals believed that the public would turn away from the sun, that they would feel that they had been somehow swindled or deceived or manipulated. But in point of fact, that's not what happened. Everyone really just sort of admired the incredible erudition and imagination with which Locke had been able to pull this off, and they continued to give the sun their business. And the sun's circulation skyrocketed as a result of this. Yeah, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the sun surpassed the Times of London as the most widely read newspaper in the entire world. This is a newspaper that had been started only 2 years earlier, being sold on street corners by street urchins, was now the most widely read newspaper in the world. And other newspapers or other publishers, seeing the success of the Sun, began to start penny papers in their own cities. And you begin to see papers like the Baltimore Sun and the Cleveland Plain Dealer and the New Orleans Times-Picayune, papers that still exist today, were started in the wake of the success of the Sun, in large part on the back of the success of the Moon series. So the Sun was really instrumental in creating a nation of newspaper readers. And it's really remarkable that is in large part on the basis of this remarkable hoax.
It even reached a point where people would use the word moon hoax or moon hoaxy or similar variations to describe something that was a bit suspect, that was a little bit suspicious. Like it became shorthand or just a point of comparison every time you wanted to describe a something that you shouldn't trust.
I mean, the problem for Locke was that he was never able to really live it down. You know, I mean, he was a remarkable person. He was certainly the best writer among the reporters in New York at that time, one of the most well-educated, and politically very progressive at a time in New York when that was very uncommon for newspaper editors. But he was never really able to live down the success of this hoax, and he became associated with that, and that's how people knew him. And you know, for years and years, he was known as Richard Adams Locke, author of the Moon Hoax, when in fact he was really a great deal more than that.
Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast. I'll put a link up to your book on the website so people can go buy it, read it, believe it, and then perhaps in 100 years' time, you'll be exposed as a massive hoaxster as well.
Yeah.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.